The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.
Now, we want to move on with an item that contains material that's not suitable for little ears. It contains details of rape and child abuse, which some listeners may find distressing. For 45 years, the truth about the sex abuse scandal at the Kinkora Boys Hostel in Belfast has remained beyond reach. Award-winning former BBC journalist Chris Moore has doggedly investigated this story for over four decades. He's utilised exclusive access to witnesses, secret documents and whistleblowers, and his new book, Kinkora, exposes the rampant sexual abuse of young boys that took place in the Kinkora Boys' home in Belfast. It also lays bare the shocking attempts by the Northern Irish Police, the British establishment and MI5 to cover it up. Chris Moore, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, I remember the name Kinkora came up again. Every decade there was another scandal about Kinkora, whether it was the original offences or the cover-ups. But it started way back in 1958 when it was opened. What was it for?
The purpose of Kinkora was to help young men in public care make the transition from school to the workplace. So it was aimed at young people in the 14 to 18 age bracket.
So they would be kids that hadn't got a good home life and were taken out of their homes and given this alternative home.
Yes, and quite often they came from broken homes and they were placed in a place by the courts. They would describe Kinkora as a place of safety.
A place of safety. It started in 1958. The abuse came out in 1980, which is 22 years later. When do you know that the abuse started and who was running the home?
Well, Joe Maines was in charge of the home from the very beginning. The complaints about him began in 1964. I've looked back at the record of complaints. There were complaints through the 60s about Joe Maines, and then latterly in the 60s about his assistant, who had absolutely no training whatsoever, but who was also a paedophile, and that was Raymond Semple. And things accelerated when the third person came to the home, who was a homosexual but also a paedophile, and that was William McGrath. And things went through the roof then, the complaints and the level of complaints to the police, to social workers, from residents and from their parents.
So it was out there, the noise was there about what was going on in the home, and yet nothing was done.
That's exactly right. And the problem is, the police looked at these investigations, they took the complaints, but Joe Maines was a master of being able to fob them off. For example, he would say, well, you know, he says I put my hands on his privates. Well, I had to look, you know, I was just looking at his underwear to make sure he was changing it. And he always had plausible deniability about his explanation.
Now, was there in the early days any attempt by the police, the RUC at the time, to do nothing, to say, no, this is too dodgy. We've got a whole pile of people who are well connected on the in the Orange Order and so on. We're not going to go there.
They certainly didn't have any enthusiasm to investigate. And I discovered after the trial in which the three Kinkora staff were among six men jailed, I discovered that in 1975, 5 years before the Irish Independent broke the story, the RUC closed down one investigation that the officer was investigating a man who was abusing his nephew, and he was led to Kinkora. He conducted his own surveillance. He took photographs, got car registration numbers, got names. He got two justices of the peace, businessmen going in, and two Northern Ireland office officials, both of whom were MI5.
So he's going to bring his report then to his superiors. Where is that report going to go? Nowhere.
Well, exactly. He was told, don't do anything. Forget about Kinkora. Prosecute the uncle. And that's what he did, because he observed orders. But I also found, also in 1975, at about the same time, an army intelligence officer called Brian Gemmell, he's now deceased. Brian went to the head of MI5 in the whole of Northern Ireland, a man called Ian Cameron. He said, McGrath's working in Kinkora. we have concerns that he is molesting children.
This McGrath was one of their informants.
Yes.
So he's working, his day job is...
He's working for MI5, but not for Army Intelligence, where Brian came from. So Brian didn't know about that.
Okay, so Brian, he wouldn't care whether this guy was revealed or not because he wasn't one of their informants. He was an MI5 informant.
And the person who knew he was MI5 was Cameron.
Okay, so now we move on to 1980 and the Irish Independent break the story.
Yes, they break the story, and it comes about, as I've subsequently learned, from the courage of two social workers, two female social workers. I've spoken to them in the years since. They went to the Irish Independent because they had written up a report expressing concern about the potential sexual relationship between Joe Maynes and one of the Kinkora residents called Richard Kerr. They were told to remove that reference from their reports, and they did that, but they didn't remove it from their original reports. They kept those intact, and that's why they went to the newspaper to get this into the public domain.
Now, the what was going on there? There were people, important people, shall we say, as part of what now emerged as a paedophile ring.
Yes. And they were on both sides of the border. Children who were staying in Kinkora were being taken to local hotels. They were being given alcoholic drinks. When they were drunk, they were then being asked to go upstairs to meet these men, or they would go with the men from the bar to the bedroom. And they went to private houses. They often referred to being taken to a castle. Well, it turns out the castle was in Classybone.
Classybone in Sligo.
Yeah. And
at Mullaghmoor with the Mountbatten, his holiday home.
Yes, that's correct.
And they do allege that Mountbatten was one of the abusers.
Well, there are five boys who have now said that Mountbatten was abusing them and raping them. I have spoken to three personally. The last one I spoke to and found was after the book had been written, but I found him in the Republic of Ireland. He lives here now in the Republic, and he described being sexually assaulted by
Every bold journey starts with a decision to go, and if you're ready, the Defender is too. This is a vehicle built for more, whether you're heading off the grid or just getting out of town for the weekend. Defender is a true icon reimagined for a new generation. Its rugged exterior is built from durable materials and tested in the toughest conditions. Inside, it's modern, functional, and refined, with smart storage and premium touches that keep you comfortable wherever the road leads. It's packed with tech, like 3D surround cameras, clear sight ground and rear views, driver assist features, and an intuitive infotainment system. With three models, the Defender 90, 110, and 130, there's a Defender for every kind of adventure. From city streets to remote trails, this is a vehicle that, like you, is capable of great things. Explore the full Defender lineup at LandRoverUSA.com.
Nearly home. Isn't home where we all want to be? Reba here for Realtor.com, the pro's number one most trusted app. Finding a home is like dating. You're not just looking for a place to live. You're searching for the one. That's where Realtor.com comes in. Like any good matchmaker, they know exactly where to look. With over 500,000 new real listings straight from the pros every month, you could find your perfect match today. Ranch style with a pool, barn dominium with an in-law suite, Realtor.com's got them. Modern craftsman with a big yard and a treehouse out back, Realtor.com will have you saying, yep, that's the one. No more swiping. It's time to start finding. Download the Realtor.com app today, cause you're nearly home. Make it real with Realtor.com.
Pros number one most trusted app based on August 2024 proprietary survey. Over 500,000 new listings every month based on average new for sale and rental listings, February 2024 through January 2025.
In London.
My goodness. So it wasn't just in Classybone.
Oh,
elsewhere.
No.
Now, the guy who's running the home, Maynes, he would prostitute these boys out, basically.
Well, Richard Kerr said to me that he used to take pictures of the boys when they were naked, and he would then present those to his clients, and he would say, here are the boys that I can service you with. Which one would you like? So it was a bizarre kind of mail order that he was running. The policeman who ran all the investigations into Kurunkura complained that MI5 obstructed his investigation. He was a good friend of mine. He at one time smuggled me into Castlereagh on the floor of his car with a blanket over me, and we went round the other side. So he was disgusted by that interference from MI5, but no one could do anything about it. And MI5 have been instrumental in covering up what's been going on at Kurunkura and what their role in it was.
Now, the man who was working for MI5, McGrath, who had a jail sentence, why did he accept that jail sentence, do you think? I mean, he had information which might have got him a deal. Or maybe that was a deal.
Well, that might have been the deal, because at the time, I remember being in court on the day that the sentencing was to take place. And first of all, there were five people who admitted the charges. There was one person who was going to fight the charges. That person was called McGrath. The McGrath's barrister went down to the cells that morning. We were all waiting, thinking all this stuff is going to come out in the public domain. When his barrister came back up from the prison cells, he said, "My client wants to be rearraigned." And McGrath, at the last moment, decided he was going to plead guilty.
So what went on in the holding cell below the court? That's what we can never
know.
That's
the question, yes.
Now, how many investigations were there, Chris, over the years, and how many of them were frustrated?
There were seven investigations. Four of them were of the civil type, and three of them were police investigations. The civil investigations were the first one was proposed by Jim Pryor, the Conservative Secretary of State, in 1982, after the trial. He wanted to have a public inquiry which would have the powers of the High Court to compel witnesses and to compel documents. I provided in that book that I've just written evidence that MI5 contested that vigorously. Their lawyer, their legal advisor, Bernard Sheldon, fought a magnificent one-man band campaign against that, referred to the police investigations as the stupid police investigations have got us caught up in this. So he persuaded the government to give us a watered-down inquiry under an English judge that MI5 wanted, and that inquiry was the Judge Hughes inquiry. It looked at social services and social care, but it didn't look at police or MI5.
Now, if it all had come out, what sort of figures would have fallen due to a proper, thorough investigation? I mean, police implicated as part of the paedophile ring, politicians?
Yeah, politicians were part of it. If you are aware, there was a man from Northern Ireland whose brother was a leading light in the Orange Order. His name was Robin Bryans. He wrote under the pen name of Robert Harbinson. But he told me in 1990 in his home in London about Lord Mountbatten, about Anthony Blunt, about a man called Peter Montgomery, whose family owned estates, big estates in Warwickshire and in Five Mile Town, and also talked about Sir Knox Cunningham. Now, Sir Knox Cunningham, as it happens, was the unionist leader, but he was also very highly thought of in Westminster, was the permanent private secretary to Harold Macmillan. These were leading officials, and they were involved in a paedophile ring.
So this is, if you remember Lord Denning's famous remark about the Birmingham Six, the appalling vista. The establishment could not tolerate if this appalling vista came to light.
No, and that's the interesting thing, because there are many other names. I haven't used them all, but there are many other names in the English establishment that have been protected. And the English establishment has gone out of its way to besmirch the good name of whistleblowers in the Kurunkura case. They've told lies to Parliament. For 15 years, Maggie Thatcher and her government told lies to Parliament because they were not being properly informed by the Ministry of Defence about a whistleblower whose claims to have been working for the Secret Services were true. They didn't admit to that for 15 years.
Was this Colin Wallace you were talking about? Colin Wallace went to jail for his pains.
Yes. Went to jail. Did 6 years in jail.
Now, and he was compensated ultimately, but, you know, the truth still didn't manage to get out.
No, he's still fighting for the truth. But what has come out are documents. For example, he appealed against the wrongful dismissal by the Ministry of Defence. Well, we've now got documents to show that MI5 interfered in a due process, and they got the chairman of the appeal board in the civil service to read documents quietly, not take them away, just read them, and no doubt those were documents which dirtied the name of Colin Wallace before that tribunal took place.
So where does the whole thing stand now? I mean, many of the principles are long gone.
Yes, many are long gone, and the government, I think, are engaged in a programme of obfuscation, downright lies. They've hidden away files which, under the 30-year rule, should be made public. These files are hidden away until the year 2065 and 2085. Most of us will be gone by then, well, I certainly will. And I wonder if they'll ever see light of day, because after all those years, will they just
will people
quietly?
Care?
Yeah, well, will they care? And will the government even bother?
I mean, one of the problems, I suppose, is the Mountbatten problem. If this is all true, and you can't definitively state that it happened, but you have the testimony of those who claim that it did.
Yeah.
I mean, to protect the royal family and the royal family's name is paramount, I would think, in the British establishment. And it wasn't Lord Mountbatten the godfather of the current king?
Yes, he was. You're right about the secret services of the British state were set up in 1909. And one of the principal aims of the secret service was to protect the monarchy and the monarch's family. And that leads us, well, is that what they were doing with Prince Andrew? Is that what they're doing with Lord Mountbatten? The evidence, by the way, is not just mine alone. Andrew Lowney was and is a distinguished historian in London. And for many years, he researched the Mountbatten family. He got access to FBI files until the British stopped the FBI from giving him any more files. He spent £500,000 of his own money ensuring that he could find out the truth of where Mountbatten was spending his time and whereabouts and who was protecting him.
Is this the end of your particular task, this book?
It feels like the end. Mm-hmm. And to be truthful, after 45 years, I'm not sure I can go any further. But I do hope that others will take it on. Listen, there are people, kids, who are now men, and they're going into their 70s and they haven't a clue about the extent of the cover-up that they had to endure.
Well, the book is called Kinkora, Britain's Shame, subtitled Mountbatten, MI5, The Belfast Boys' Home Sex Abuse Scandal and the British Cover-Up. It's available now in all good bookshops. It is published by Merrion Press and its author, Chris Moore. Chris, thank you very much for joining us in studio today. Now, if you've been impacted by anything discussed, you can contact the Rape Crisis Centre National Helpline, 1-800-77-88-88. And for those in Northern Ireland, the 24/7 Domestic and Sexual Abuse Helpline is 0808-802.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.